In other words, in countries like ours and times like the present, people are developing their personalities. And especially persons who have qualities of leadership, who have above average desire to achieve. The phrase that I think I used in this class, the praise of Yahweh, of the prophet Daniel, praising him. The Latin sounds so nice. Let me give it first. Because he was a vir desideriorum. Because he was a man of desires. God loves people who have desires. And strong desires. Peter had strong desires. Paul had strong desires. Mary Magdalene had strong desires. And consequently, it's to recognize that people have and have had developed in modern times through education and the whole culture in which we're living. This desire to achieve. Of course, in religious life, it must be controlled. It must be balanced. But it should not be crushed. You know what I'm trying to say? And whatever else the new code of canon law is going to reveal, it is this feature that members of religious institutes must, of course, be humble, must practice charity, must recognize their place in the community. No virtue has changed. But society has changed. People have changed. And grace builds on whatever nature it has.
I was going to say, St. Benedict agreed with you, Father, in saying what you say. In his chapter on to superiors, he says that the superior should never be so zealous that he would break the vessel that is entrusted to his care. I think that's pretty well what the chapter says, as I remember.
And Christ himself, remember? He speaks of not crushing.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells superiors, did I have this on the board just to see it once? Again, I feel such an urge to use Latin that when I do, it gives me a chance for self-expression that I don't normally have. So, Christ said in the Latin Vulgate is the official language of the Church for the Bible, not ministrari, but ministrare. Not to be served, passive voice, but to serve. He told the apostles this, and through them he's told all popes, bishops, and superiors in the world. Not to be ministered unto. And the night before he died, he did the dramatic thing of washing the feet of his disciples, which some Protestant sects, the Mennonites, for example, consider a sacrament. That was instituted by Christ, but not precisely as a sacrament. It took the church to decide there are only seven. But the act of humiliation, which Christ practiced at the Last Supper, was his way of teaching the apostles, and through them all superiors, that they are to serve. But notice, never to serve in the sense of being subservient. There wasn't a humbler person than Paul. But did Paul ever know that he had authority? no one has any doubt, surely anyone in office, that the hardest thing is to combine these two. But they had better be combined. Otherwise, those that are under the care of superiors, and I would say the first few months almost, certainly by the end of the second year, a religious coming into a community adjusts, has to adjust. As I discovered, I had to adjust in 3 months as a condition for survival. I said to myself, there was enough pride in me, hardened. They're not going to throw you out, as he told me he would. I'll cultivate any virtue, including humility. I speak as one who painfully knows. And what I hope the Lord is pleased with what I'm doing, all I know is that the freedom that superiors have given me after they had duly humiliated me in my early years was due to the fact that I didn't feel crushed. And I've always felt that I must defer to superiors. Brother?
I just noticed your plan on what you mentioned about to serve rather than to be served. But I think that, too, I think we have to have a firm and yet prudent allowance for people who live with us to serve us so that they can practice virtue, too. The reason I say that, I think a lot of times I'm reading and seeing that in an effort to implement this service, this willingness to serve, and the authorities' willingness to serve, they at times they do not allow the members that live with them, they won't even allow them to have the opportunity to practice the virtue of charity towards them. And I'm saying, you'll see this very often in geriatrics amongst older religious, where they want to help others, but when somebody else offers them help, oh, they become very, oh, no, you know. And I think there's a humility in being allowed to be served too. You know, do you understand?
Oh, yes, because members of a community, especially engaged in any kind of apostolate, will then individually have people somehow under them. That's very true. This is not an easy balance to attain. But I did want to bring out the need for controlling, developing, without crushing. And because one who is an authority has the authority and can simply say, you must do this or may not do that. And this, I think, is one thing that happened also in communities that, say, have secularized. Where instead of standing up to one's God-given rights, you might see obedience became subservience to a person, a human being, even at the price of disobeying God. So this is a very subtle, but I think a most important personality. By the way, we all have some of it, and I would say this, speaking in general, having taught religious for so many years, over 500 of my own Jesuits in theology, I would generalize and say that with rare exception, most religions have some features of the aggressive personality. It takes, I think, above average self expression, even to want to become a religious. And then the person does the unheard of thing of joining a community, which is perfect for controlling this personality. Okay. Number 5, help the person to direct their tendency to dominate. And this in general is the description of an aggressive personality, to direct their desire to dominate to a good purpose. In other words, to want to dominate is not bad. In fact, all that dominate comes from, and you know, dominare is the same as dominus. In other words, nobody would be an authority unless there were something in nature on which grace built to want to, well, not dominate others, but to govern others, to rule others. And this is where I think you've got a point too, brother, that in a democratic society like ours, the idea of dominating anybody is almost anathema. In fact, in my class today is what? Saturday. My Thursday night class, I was lecturing in New York on authority and pointed out that critics of Christianity have nicknamed Christians as having heteronymous personalities. Heteronymous personalities. Even to hear the word sounds bad. Heteronymous. Well, heteronymous comes from heteros, which means other. A personality that, well, is on religious principles subservient to others. Whereas the kind of personality that the modern world claims is the only authentic personality is autonomous. I think I have it here. On page 41, I remembered from Thursday night's class, you've all heard about Immanuel Kant, K-A-N-T. The greatest philosophical mind in the Western world in modern times. Devastating, disastrous philosophy. But I would say, no question, the most influential mind in the last 400 years. Lived and died a Protestant. Here's what he says. This is regarding conscience. And the Western world has practically redefined conscience in these terms. Let me read. We need not wonder when we look upon all previous efforts that have been made to discover the principle of morality, why they have one and all been bound to fail. No other system of morality is sound until Immanuel Kant came along. Their authors saw man as tied to laws by his duty, laws from outside of him. But it never occurred to them, and he would say it never even occurred to Christ, that man is subject. Now listen to this. This one sentence describes the morality of the Western world. It never occurred to them that man is subject only to laws which are made by himself. Man is subject only to laws which are made by himself. Where nomos is law and autos is self. Now, we are dealing here with a bedrock of the moral order when we talk about the aggressive personality. because we do have a free will, we are individual and, in a good sense, independent persons. But what we must do is direct this desire to a worthy purpose. And provided the purpose is a good one, then this aggressive personality is being used to good purpose. Finally, one last item. Not all religious institutes can use such personalities. Now, that's a strong statement. What I mean by that is that some persons are so strongly aggressive that, well, they probably should find expression in other communities. I don't mean that a certain amount of aggressiveness is not characteristic of every normal human being, but with some people, depending on their age and background, it may be very strongly developed even by the time they've entered the religious life. In some cases, those in charge of formation or superiors don't know how to deal with such a person, or at least maybe the kind of work which the community expects of its members before they would get their aggressive personality under control, they might have so changed or been so changed that it would be difficult to use that person, at least successfully, in the apostolate engaged in by that institute. Some people, maybe because of their early background, I know myself, being an only child, my mother less than 5 foot tall, I knew the meaning of grace, though I didn't reflect on it, long before I had studied theology. To control an only child, an only son, and she had to work to support the two of us. She did it by love and also by a lot of prayer. But there are certain traits developed in some people from early years. You inherit that kind of a person in the postulants, your novitiate. And you ask yourself, what do we do? So it might be that this community, given this kind of people in charge, with this or that kind of apostolate, well, might well say, I think you would find your peace elsewhere. Does that make sense? And not tell the person you don't have a vocation, but maybe humbly admit, we don't know how to cope with you. And, for example, just to distinguish between, well, I would say the Society of Jesus, even in its best days, and, well, the Carthusians, or the Camaldolese. We almost look for, and this, of course, has caused us many problems, a more aggressive type of personality, even for a Jesuit vocation. All I know is that without extraordinary prayer and union with God, the more freedom, the more autonomy, the more what we call aggressiveness an individual has, the more that person must be united with God. Because, frankly, there are some persons that nobody, but nobody except God, can control.
I think that the business of autonomy, I think young people coming into religious life today have really been, and I say this generally speaking, have really been sort of more or less bred in this whole concept of secular psychology. Because I think one of the most frequent things you hear in the beginning of formation today is a frequent reference to a lack of consideration on our part for their personal maturity. I think that this, you hear that quite a bit, you know. And I think that I think from the start they have to be told or taught that often a religious personal maturity, social and secular thinking, and religious obedience do not go together at all. Religious obedience calls us to faith. A lot of times when we don't even understand, but we're still called to faith. And I think that's a very important point to bring out.
Well, I think too, brother, along that same line, I think you're correct. Along that same line, they must recognize that there is a certain maturation or being grown up in things worldly, in things secular. I think the young people are exposed to more secular knowledge now than human beings ever had before. I don't think it's all good for them. I think they are top-heavy with information and data. There's a certain unreal maturity. There's a certain acquisition of knowledge or exposure to information and even the having of experience which they don't know how to cope with. And consequently, I think what they need especially is to be trained in their faith. Because the same people that can be so erudite and so knowledgeable in things of the world can be dismally ignorant in the things of God. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
In other words, there are two worlds. There is the world of man and the world of God. And the world of man has indeed, I think, developed the people to meet, you might say, the needs or the problems of the world. Because, as the expression goes, it's a dog-eat-dog world. And I think they have developed an almost brutal aggressiveness, some of them, without realizing it. They will tell you things, they'll tell you off. I won't even say where, but within the last several days I was lecturing to a community, and the superior was there, and she just told me after I had said something out loud, "You're wrong." Well, it happens I was right. I just happened to be right. Well, I have been wrong. But, you know, you gulp and you smile and you go on. There are ways and ways of dealing with people, which I think the world has almost assume that unless you keep asserting yourself and demanding your rights, you're not going to get them. And consequently, this is where I think especially familiarity with Christ is so important. For many reasons, well, for all reasons, Christ is the perfect pattern for all of us, even though we were not religious, to imitate. But I don't think there is any area that is more practically important than this one. No one more than Christ was, in the best sense, an aggressive personality. And the balance, the careful balance between aggressiveness and prudence, aggressiveness and charity, aggressiveness and humility, That's Christ. Brother?
Father, I think you mentioned about they coming with somewhat heavy knowledge, and I think that a lot of times, too, when they come in, there's really a sincere desire to know and love God. But I think because they've had a lack of training and faith, they tend to substitute secular knowledge that makes up for their lack of spiritual knowledge. Do you know what I'm saying? They have some idea of the spiritual, the faith, but because they don't have, they haven't taken the opportunity, or they haven't been given the opportunity to develop this knowledge of this spiritual knowledge of faith, they substitute, they'll interject and pluck secular knowledge into that.
That judging by the standards of this world, and even years later, you will find they're making decisions that are based on worldly wisdom rather than the divine faith. And you wonder why you're correcting them or suggesting that they might change. They've got this thing all figured out. The only thing missing is the first premise. The first premise is not God's revelation, but the worldly wisdom which they have been brought up on for years. Can I go on to the next section, brother?
Well, I don't want to hold your problem, really, but the only thing I would say is it doesn't only what you've been, Brother Magellan has been saying so far, it doesn't only deal with people of the aggressive personality. I think it deals just generally with all people entering the religious life. I think that the As you said earlier, they have an autonomy about them that perhaps we never had perhaps the opportunity to experience before we entered.
I'm not saying
it's right, or I'm not saying it's wrong. You know.
But it must be, first of all, it must be recognized.
It is there, though.
And what we must also recognize is the distinction, and how important this is, between a legitimately developed autonomy and an autonomy that really is, Immanuel Kant here says, makes its own laws and calls it conscience. It's against my conscience. What do you mean it's against your conscience? It's against what I want to do. And nobody is supposed to have the right to tell the person. There is no other, even the great other, capital O, God, who is to tell me and inform my conscience, which is in the mind. In fact, there is no more basic truth in our faith. Conscience, as Christianity understands it, is the mind. It's not the will. It's the mind which passes judgment on what is morally good or morally bad, but that mind has to be informed from the outside. The mind, by definition, is the intaking faculty. It is informed both by nature around it and especially by God's revelation that certain things are wrong. I brought with me the pastoral letter of Bishop Stewart from Australia on abortion. It is a frightening pastoral letter. He says most of the countries in the world now, for the first time in history, have legalized abortion. In other words, autonomy, that I am my own. My will determines whether, having conceived a child, I want that child to be born. My will. In other words, it is self-deification. What do you mean, your will? Conscience is not your will. Conscience is your mind, which must be enlightened from outside of itself, and then in the light of that conscience, then my will is to conform to the will of the one who informed my mind, namely God. Well, that language. So this we must distinguish between the autonomy which is legitimate and an autonomy that has become self-idolatry. Sister.
Father, I find with the people more and more when the religious life for me, if I'm having, for instance, if I were having difficulty with you, I would try to deal with it within my soul on the level of virtue. Young people now, if they're having difficulty with someone, they think it's great hypocrisy if they don't tell them exactly how they feel right at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, somehow.
They fail in prudence. And they fail to recognize that there is a virtue within them that can deal with so many things in that way they can go through.
If they've got a thought, they automatically think they have a right to express it.
And they think it's hypocrisy if they don't, Father. They have been...
That there is no such thing as a hidden thought.
Mm-hmm.
And that the greatest self-control is control of my thinking.
When the people bring up something that immediately they have a thought and they bring it up, am I correct, since they are of that personality, am I just as correct in correcting them publicly?
Oh, I should say.
Whereas I might not.
Yes. No, you have to do it calmly. In other words, show as little emotion as possible so they don't feel that you're personal about it, but that you're objective, you want to help them. Yes. In fact, this is where, in the process of formation and training, you're really living in a different world. There are things these people should be told that maybe even 10 years ago they didn't have to be told. Or maybe not as publicly. Now, of course, they must in time be trained, and one way they're trained is by the example we give. Not to unnecessarily humiliate them, as might be for a correction in public. But one remarkable thing that I have found, and I've been dealing with people, especially my own judges, for too many years not to know this. It's remarkable how the same person who can be totally indifferent to your feelings, he is extremely sensitive about his feelings. They can tell you anything, and you're supposed to take it. And you say anything, and they feel that you're being offensive. So, this is fallen human nature. It would be good to read at least a few authors that are thoroughly sound doctrinally, but also very knowledgeable psychologically. Because often it's not a matter, for example, of virtue on the part of the individual you're dealing with. It may be they don't realize they're acting wrong psychologically. They're doing stupid things, which happen also to be morally wrong. And they might be more accessible to instruction on a psychological level than maybe on a strictly religious level, especially when they're young and still unformed spiritually.
This concludes Father John Hardin's class on the subject entitled The Aggressive Personality.